Come back. So here's the overall map again of where we are. Namely, we arrived at the formulation of the Klein-Gordon equation on curved space-time in the first quantized scenario still. We haven't implemented the commutation relations yet. But we figured out last time what the canonically conjugate momentum field is to phi. And so therefore, we should be ready now to quantize. Now, today's lecture is going to be rather fundamental for all of quantum field theory in curved space-time, because we're going to see why it's working. We're going to find out why it is. We're going to prove that you can quantize that theory. It's not going to be full of practical methods necessarily, but it's an important insight into how the quantum field theory really works. By the way, in case there are some who watch this on video, let me remind them that the description of the project is already posted on the homepage, and it's easy. So just check that out. Okay. Right, so let's quantize the theory. What does that mean? Solving a quantum field theory means we have to solve three things: commutation relations, hermeticity conditions, and the equations of motion. So here are the commutation relations, where these pi are the canonically conjugate momentum fields that we identified last time. Then the hermeticity condition, remember that we started with a real-valued Klein-Gordon field, so this is going to be self-adjoint operator valued now, and the same for the canonically conjugate one. And then the equations of motion. The equations of motion are of this form: if f hat is some observable, some self-adjoint operator, then d by dt of that has to be 1 over I h bar commutator of f with h. And so you could choose for f, for example, phi or pi. Now, if you do this for phi and pi, you obtain the following two equations of motion. The first one is the Klein-Gordon equation. Remember, it looks so messy because this is all happening on curved space-time now. But if the metric is chosen to be just eta, then this is just second time derivative minus Laplacian. So we have this Klein-Gordon equation to solve. And the second equation of motion is just a relationship between the canonically conjugate momentum and phi. If g is chosen to be the eta of flat space-time, then this just becomes d by dt, d by dx naught. So then we have pi is phi dot again. But in general, this is more complicated now, especially because there are four terms over here, because this nu is running from 0 to 3. So this is going to involve the time derivative, but it's also going to involve the space derivatives. So how can we solve these three problems: the canonical commutation relations, the hermeticity condition, and the equations of motion? To get inspired for how to solve this, let us remember how the solution looked like for Minkowski space. Let us look at the structure of it. So for Minkowski space, we had that the quantum field that solves all of these requirements takes this exact form here, where the A and A dagger K obey the canonical commutation relations. So these are some operators that we can write down explicitly as matrices. We can build a Fock space by postulating a vector that's annihilated by A, and then we can apply a dagger multiple times to get the basis of that Hilbert space, and so on. These are these operators A and A dagger. Remember that any operators A and A dagger that obey the commutation relations can be used to generate a Hilbert space and a Hilbert space basis in there. Okay, so the field phi was expressed as a linear combination where we integrate over all momentum space, linear combination of A and A daggers with functions of space and time in front of them. And we define pi to be phi hat dot. So this was the complete solution Now the strategy to replicate that success for generic curved spacetime is going to be this. First of all, we're going to ensure that the hermeticity condition is solved by construction. We just write that something down that cannot fail to be Hermitian, right? We just write it down in this way. And secondly, we will separate the two problems of obeying the canonical commutation relations and the equations of motion. We will write the ansatz for the solution in such a way that part of it will be only responsible for solving the canonical commutation relations, and another part of it will be only responsible for solving the equations of motion. And we'll do it in such a way that if each part does its job, then the whole thing obeys all of it. So how do we do this in practice? First, we want to ensure hermeticity, that this is by construction guaranteed. Well, here's the ansatz. Here's an ansatz that will do it. Namely, if we write phi hat as sum over k, where these don't have to be momenta. Here in this case, they were momenta. But on curved spacetime, there may not exist anything like momenta. Because momentum, what is that? I mean, this is, you know, a plane wave, e to the power ikx. It's a plane wave. What is a plane wave on a generic curved spacetime? It's like trying to draw a chessboard on a curved spacetime with ripples everywhere. You can't draw a chessboard. I mean, you can, but they're all going to look like paintings by Salvador Dali, right? They're going to all have odd angles. You can't have everything right angles there. So we can't expect to have plane waves. We can't expect to have momenta, momentum eigenvectors here. So k, in general, we will accept to be other parameters. In a special case, there might be momenta. In other cases, there might not be. So mimicking what's going on over here, we will write a sum over k, just like the integral over the k. Now, we write here a sum knowing that, yeah, sometimes it might be an integral. Like in Minkowski space, that might be an integral. But in general, it could also be a sum. It's just like in quantum mechanics, where a resolution of the identity can be written sometimes as an integral, sometimes as a sum. In Hilbert space, you can choose a countable basis or uncountable pseudo basis, like the position vectors and the momentum eigenvectors. They would be uncountable. So we'll be flexible about this. Sum or integral, k could be momentum, could be another bunch of parameters. But the overall structure is going to be that we write down here a function, just like this function, but we don't claim that we know already what it's going to look like, some function times ak operators plus, and this is the point, complex conjugate, Hermitian conjugate of that. So therefore, the whole thing is bound to be Hermitian, right? No matter what function we choose here, since here we put the complex conjugate, and since this is the Hermitian conjugate of that, this is guaranteed to be Hermitian. Just take the dagger of that term, and it becomes this, dagger of that term becomes this. So the hermeticity condition is guaranteed. All right, so we have this. Then we want to separate the problem of solving the canonical commutation relations from the problem of solving the equations of motion. Now, the problem of solving the equations of motion is two problems. We have the Klein-Gordon equation as one equation of motion, and the relationship between pi and phi as the other equation of motion. So this other equation of motion, the relationship between phi and pi, we solve by construction. We say, if we have phi, we define pi to be this. Done. So that equation of motion is done already. So what are we still stuck with? We have now guaranteed the hermeticity of both phi and pi, right? Because if phi is Hermitian, this stuff is all real, so that's also going to be Hermitian. Okay, so the hermeticity condition is already fulfilled for both phi and pi. We also have the equation of motion that relates pi to phi by construction. What we still need to do is solve the Klein-Gordon equation and the canonical commutation relations. These two problems can be separated from another. And in fact, by mimicking this structure over here, namely having a function times the a and a daggers, by mimicking this structure, we are separating these two problems. The reason is this. These guys, don't have any x or t dependence, right? They have no space-time dependence. As far as space and time derivatives, these guys are concerned. These guys are just constants. Constant operators, constant matrices. But they're non-commutative. Whereas these things are non-trivial functions of x and t, but as far as operators are concerned, they're just scalar, right? They're just numbers. So therefore, these prefactor functions here, these so-called mode functions, will be responsible, or we are responsible, to choosing them in such a way that this phi obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. And the A in A daggers will be responsible for getting the canonical commutation relations right. So the non-commutativity sticks in these. The time and space dependence is encoded in those. Let's see what all of this means. With this ansatz, it's not guaranteed that we succeed, right? We are talking about generic curved space-times. There could be 500 black holes in this space-time, and it might be expanding in one area and contracting in another. So we want to find out in generality whether we can solve this, whether this ansatz will succeed. So far, no guarantee. It's just a hope that a suitable time dependence for these guys will make the Klein-Gordon equation solved, and that we also get the canonical commutation relations right. So how does this play out? First of all, yes, we used A and A dagger operators with the usual commutation relations because we know how to handle those. And then these mode functions, uk of x and t, still have to be determined. But one thing we can already read off is that if we choose these uk of x and t to be solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, number-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, well then, automatically, phi hat obeys the Klein-Gordon equation. Why is that? You see, the claim is that if this is a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, then that is a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. Why? Well, this has a space-time dependence, right? This doesn't. So this might as well be the number 5 as far as the Klein-Gordon equation is concerned, because this is just constant, right? Now, if this is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then any linear combination of these guys is also a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, because it's linear. So if each uk of x and t is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then also the sum over all of these is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And because the Klein-Gordon equation has only real coefficients, it doesn't mix the imaginary and the complex parts. And therefore, if uk of x and t is a, in general, complex-valued solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, then also its complex conjugate is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Therefore, all of these terms are also solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. So this gives us a strategy. We will demand, or we will simply choose as an ansatz, here, solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. So that means we can already solve the full quantum field theoretical problem, except for one condition. You see, we have the hermeticity guaranteed. Hermeticity condition is guaranteed for phi and pi. We have this equation of motion. And we have the Klein-Gordon equation also holding for the phi hat. As long as we choose here some number-valued function of space and time, which happens to solve the Klein-Gordon equation. Now you may wonder, are we done here? Can I not just take the Klein-Gordon equation, solve it, find one solution of it, if need be, numerically? So I get one function u of x and t, I write it in here, I write the complex conjugate of it over there, and I forget about the sum here, because if one of them is a solution, then you know the sum of these two is also a solution, we have a solution here, we're done. It's true that we solved the Klein-Gordon equation in this way, but something is still missing. Something that will force us to actually consider a sum here over many k. There is a reason why we can't get away with just having one solution in here. And the reason is that we haven't taken care of the canonical commutation relations yet. We have to check them, right? If we could try to just put one solution in here, then we have everything, Klein-Gordon equation, hermeticity, everything, except for the canonical commutation relations. Let's see what the requirement of the canonical commutation relations does. So we try this ansatz, we find hermeticity is okay by construction. Then the first equation of motion, the Klein-Gordon equation, holds because in our ansatz here, we are assuming that these functions here are individually solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. Therefore, any linear combination of them is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. And these guys are just constants, the A and A dagger. Also, the second equation of motion, the relationship between pi hat and phi is also guaranteed because by construction, it's how we define pi. So now, critical piece. Checking the canonical commutation relations. It shouldn't come as a surprise that's non-trivial because that's what quantization is, right? If it was just as easy as solving the classical equations of motion, then quantization would be easy. So we have to check the canonical commutation relations. In particular, this one. I mean, the phi-phi commutativity, pi-pi commutativity is trivial. So the phi-pi non-commutativity has to be exactly this. If we look at the commutator of phi and pi at equal time, then it's got to be the Dirac delta. Where, on our space-time, we have, of course, many different ways to slice it into space-like hypersurfaces parameterized by a parameter of time. So it's also not clear that what we do is covariant at the end. It should be independent of the slicing that we do it in. But first, let's just try to do it in some slicing. So we choose some coordinate system, and we want to impose this. I mean, actually, since the commutator can be shown to arise from a Poisson bracket, which arose from the Legendre transform of something covariant, namely the action, these things have to work out. But still, it's good to check that this is so. Anyway, how do we enforce this now? So this is the equation that we need to solve. The freedom that we can exploit to solve that equation is that we have the freedom to choose these solutions. So the question is, can we find a bunch of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation such that if we label them by k and we sum over all k, this thing is not just a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, but the phi is actually also obeying the canonical commutation relations. So in order to do this, let us plug this expansion of phi into here. Right? So this, all of this goes into the left side of the commutator. And pi can be expressed in terms of phi, right? Remember, pi is all of this in terms of phi. All of this needs to go in here. Now we can spell out what this is by spelling out what that sum is. The point being that we have here a term where nu is equal to 0, and we have the time derivative. And we also have nu equal 1, 2, 3. So we have spatial derivatives here. So pi is, just spelling this out, here are the prefactors. Here is the phi again. So we just plug this phi into here. And then you see that we get a bunch of terms, right? We get four different derivatives of all of these terms here. I mean, nu is running from 0 to 3. All right, so this pi also goes into that commutator up there. Then how does this look like? So we have that the commutator between phi hat and pi hat is given by this expression, which was our ansatz for phi. And then all of that expression, which is what our ansatz means for pi. And then let's just spell out what we get here. So we have the commutator between these terms, and remember, here's the comma, and those terms over here, and of course the A commute with the A, and the A dagger commute with the A dagger terms over here, and we get just a commutator then between the A and the A daggers. So we get the commutator between A and A dagger K prime. This will give us a Kronecker delta of K and K prime, or if we choose this to be an integral, then it would be a Dirac delta. In this case here, we write it as a discrete expansion. So we have here a Kronecker delta of A of K and K prime. That's what happens with the commutator. Remember, the whole thing is a commutator, right? And so we have number value times operator, number value times operator. So it's going to be this times that, and a Kronecker delta. And this stuff is, of course, always coming along. So what we get is this carried forward from here. Then we have the sum over k, sum over k prime. And then we have this factor and that factor, where we have just a uk here, and then we have a dx uk prime over there, and a Kronecker delta over here, coming from the A dagger commutator. And then we have the same kind of thing going on between this and that. But because it's a commutator between A dagger and A, we have that the commutator is minus Kronecker delta. So this term comes with a minus. So it's this times that with a minus sign and the Kronecker delta here. All right, so now let's see what we have. We can carry out the one of these sums, let's say the sum over k prime, because only one term will survive, the one where k prime is k, and therefore we can write that the commutator is this. So what we found is that the commutator between phi and pi, according to our ansatz, is this expression. And in order to obey the canonical commutation relations, it has to be I times Dirac delta. Now, can that possibly be done? Let's see. The lazy assumption would be to say, our ansatz involves choosing solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. What if we choose only one? Right? Remember, we get the Klein-Gordon equation if we just choose one of them. So if we don't actually sum over many solutions, but if we just choose one of them. Well, then what do we get at this point? How clever would we have to choose our single solution here? Well, let's see. Then we would have this, but it wouldn't be a sum. It would just be the solution and then derivatives of the solution and the other way around. Now, this is supposed to be the Dirac delta. There's no way it is, because these solutions are smooth functions. They're just smooth functions of the Klein-Gordon equation. There's no way you can just take smooth function derivative minus, you know, complex conjugate, and you get a distribution there. So we can see that no finite number of these guys is going to do it. We need an infinite number of them in order to actually get the Dirac delta. As it will turn out, we will need to use a basis in the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. We need a whole basis in order to do this. As you can imagine, from Fourier theory too, if you don't take all waves, you can't linearly combine them into a Dirac delta. It's just not going to be exactly Fourier here. And remember that the k doesn't have to be momentum. It's any choice of label. So clearly we need infinitely many of them. So the conclusion so far is this. We made the ansatz that the field can be written in this form. This guaranteed the hermeticity condition, and if we choose our mode functions to be solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, then phi hat is guaranteed to be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. We also found that in order for the phi and the pi to obey the canonical commutation relations, it's not sufficient to run the sum over just one term or any finite number of terms. No, we have to run it over infinitely many terms in order to have a chance that this particular expression up here, in order to have a chance that this expression here actually is adding up to a Dirac delta. So in other words, our ansatz, namely that the field can be written in this way, mode function times A and A dagger operators, will succeed to solve all of the requirements, hermeticity condition, equations of motion, and canonical commutation relations, if we can find a set of number-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Let's call them like this, the set of number-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation that we use in here. Such that, I mean, this set of solutions has to be chosen such that it obeys this condition here that we just saw arising from requiring the canonical commutation relations. This equation we denote by W, because if you remember from a course on differential equations, the Wronskian of the differential equation, that is a Wronskian here. All right, so this is the Wronskian condition that we have to impose on the mode functions for them, for our ansatz to succeed. So now let's see, how do we know that such a set of mode functions actually exists? It looks like a rather insurmountable task to come up with solutions that miraculously sum up in this way to give you a Dirac delta. Why would that work? So let's find out why that has to work and when. So here's a proposition. Let's assume that space-time is globally hyperbolic, which is to say that it possesses a foliation of, into Cauchy surfaces, which is to say that it is topologically of the form R cross some spatial manifold, for example. So we should be able to write the space, we should be able to have a time coordinate and then say at every time coordinate we have some manifold. So if we have that the space-time is globally hyperbolic, then the space-time does not possess closed time-like curves. So there's no travel into the past, which could mess up your initial conditions, right? So you can't go back and kill your grandparents or something like that before they had your parents. So having Cauchy surfaces means, a Cauchy surface is a space-like hypersurface on which you can impose initial conditions, and then they completely determine the further evolution of your fields everywhere in the future. So the proposition says that on globally hyperbolic space-times, there exist such sets of functions which obey this condition. And if you sum them all up in this way, then you get the Dirac delta. And it turns out that it's not unique. There are many such sets. There's not just one way of assembling a collection of mode functions such that you solve the quantum field theory. There are many ways, there are infinitely many ways to do this. And that's important. And depending on which kind of observer you are, the one set may be more convenient than another. It's not true that one set is truer or more correct than another, but one set may be more convenient than another. In particular, it will be super convenient to choose the mode function such that the associated A and A dagger operators have the meaning that we like to associate to them. For example, the A operator applied to what we consider to be the zero particle state should annihilate that one. And then if we apply the A dagger operator on what we consider the zero particle state, the vacuum state, then it should be the presence of one particle. So that seems like a very reasonable requirement. If we have not just one way of solving this condition, this Wronskian condition, but if there are many such collections of solutions that we can plug in there, then we might as well use that freedom to make life easy for us. And as we will see later, for example, one case would be where you are in Minkowski space and you are an inertial observer in Minkowski space. Then you would choose as your mode functions, obviously, the mode functions such that the associated A and A dagger operators are such as we just explained, right? A applied to what we consider to be the zero particle state would annihilate that state. In other words, these mode functions would be the mode functions that we already saw, e to the power I omega t minus xk, right? But now imagine it's still Minkowski space, but you are an accelerated observer. Now remember, an accelerated observer from lecture 8, the Unruh effect, an accelerated observer will see particles. Even if an observer in the lab frame, inertial in Minkowski space, doesn't see them, the accelerated observer will see his detector, his or her detector click. So for the accelerated observer, the vacuum state is a different thing. So therefore, the accelerated observer may choose, for convenience, a different collection of mode functions. Because if the accelerated observer chooses a different collection of mode functions, the accelerated observer can choose it in such a way that for the accelerated observer, it is true that when that A and A dagger operator pair, or we may call it B and B dagger or whatever, when they act on what the accelerated observer considers to be the vacuum, then it is going to be annihilated, etc. So I guess you can already see where this is going. The relationship between choosing one set of mode functions that does it and the other set of mode functions that does it is going to be a Bogoliubov transformation, right? Because each set of mode function comes with the associated A and A dagger choice in its ansatz. And they're going to be related by Bogoliubov transformations. And so we are going to see another way to recognize why accelerated observers see particles where non-accelerated inertial ones don't. There's a Bogoliubov transformation between them. All right, but that was just anticipating what will happen later in more detail. For now, we need to convince ourselves that there ought to be such things at all. Why would there be such a set of functions, of solutions of the Klein-Gödel equation that miraculously adds up to the Dirac delta function when you calculate this complicated Wronskian thing on the left? Why would there be such solutions? What guarantees that? Okay, so let's prove that W can be solved, that this Wronskian condition can be solved. So for that, let's consider the vector space V of all real-valued solutions of the Klein-Gödel equation. This is where we pick our solutions from, right? The set of all solutions of the Klein-Gödel equation. Good. I'm not completely general here, because we are saying the vector space V of all real-valued solutions of the Klein-Gödel equation. Of course, if F is a real-valued solution of the Klein-Gödel equation, and G is another real-valued solution of the Klein-Gödel equation, then F plus I times G is a complex-valued solution to the Klein-Gödel equation. Because the Klein-Gödel equation doesn't have an I in it. It will, you know, the real part and the imaginary part satisfy the Klein-Gödel equation separately. So we will soon upgrade this consideration to this space of complex-valued solutions of the Klein-Gödel equation, but it's a trivial matter of just linear combination. But let us start with the real-valued ones. See, we will later find that these mode functions, uk, will have to be complex-valued ones. You can't just We can't get away with just choosing the real value. Quite obviously, because on the right-hand side of the Wronskian condition was I times Dirac delta of x minus x prime. So if on the left-hand side everything was just real valued, there's no way that we could obey the Klein-Gödel equation, that we could obey the canonical commutation relations. All right, so we start with the vector space of real valued solutions of the Klein-Gödel equation. So it's not vector space of all real valued functions. No, it's just the solutions, right? The real valued solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation. Since it is a linear equation, these solutions form a vector space. Now, on that vector space of solutions, we can define the following inner product here. So f is a solution to the Klein-Gödel equation, a function of space and time, therefore. H is a solution of the Klein-Gödel equation, a function of space and time. And then we define an inner product between them in the following way. We do an integral over a space-like hypersurface. The sigma is a vector that's pointing orthogonal to the space-like hypersurface in the time direction. And then here we have square root of g, g mu nu, and then f derivative of h minus h derivative of f. We will later see why this is a suitable definition. For now, let us just look at what properties this inner product has. So remember what this is doing. It is giving the vector space of solutions of the Klein-Gödel equation an additional structure. It's no longer just a vector space, it's an inner product space. Because now we can no longer just add and multiply solutions of the Klein-Gödel equation to get another solution of the Klein-Gödel equation. That's what the vector space is. No, in addition, we can now also multiply two solutions. Solution, solution, and what we get is a number. Right? So we evaluate f at, I mean, sigma is some space-like hypersurface of equal time. So we take f of time, h at the same time, derivatives, etc. We integrate that over the space-like hypersurface. So this will turn into a d3x if you write it down in an explicit coordinate system. And then at the end of it, you get some number. However, it would seem that it depends on time. It depends on when this space-like hypersurface was chosen. Is this an early space-like hypersurface or a late one? It turns out that, and we will prove this later, it turns out that it's actually independent of time. The space independence is clear because we're integrating over space. But f depends on t, h depends on t, g depends on t, heck, this measure depends on t, and yet the whole thing doesn't. It's a constant. Again, if you remember the Wronskian from the theory of differential equations, this is a Wronskian. It turns out to be a Wronskian, which is the reason why it is actually constant. But I don't want to appeal to previous knowledge there. We will prove the whole thing. Okay, so the proposition that we will later prove using Stokes' theorem and the Klein-Gödel equation, the proposition is that this inner product is independent of the choice of the space-like hypersurface. And therefore, this is truly simply an inner product between two solutions. You don't have to specify when you calculate that or which space-like hypersurface you choose. Any two solutions to the Klein-Gödel equation, and then it's unique what their inner product here is. Now, is this inner product like positive definite, for example? No, it's far from that. This inner product is antisymmetric. You see, imagine you swap the roles, the places of h and f. Well, then you get the same expression, except that the h is here, the f is there, and here the other way around. So you pick up a minus sign, which means that this inner product has this property here. Fh is equal to minus hf, which means it is not what is would be called a Hermitian form if it was positive definite, if it was symmetric. So if it was symmetric, but it's not symmetric, it's anti-symmetric. So therefore, this thing is what is called a symplectic form. All right, so we have an anti-symmetric inner product here. What can we do with an anti-symmetric inner product? not diagonalize it. You see, if we had a symmetric thing, a symmetric inner product, it would be like a symmetric matrix. And symmetric matrices can be diagonalized. They're self-adjoint. But this thing is anti-symmetric. And there is no spectral theorem for it. Instead, we cannot diagonalize it, but there is another theorem, which is kind of replacing the spectral theorem for these symplectic forms. The theorem goes back to Darboux, and it says this. It says that for any non-degenerate symplectic form, so we don't want its determinant to vanish, there exists a basis, in our case, a basis in the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, such that in this basis, our symplectic form takes this shape. And the shape is a matrix, which is simply 0, 1, minus 1, 0. And then one step over, we have 1, 0, minus 1, 0, and so on. We have these blocks of 0, 1, minus 1, 0, just continually all the way down. Finitely many or infinitely many, depending on the dimension of the space of solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation here. And the rest of the matrix is zero. So we won't prove this, but it's a standard theorem, and it's not so easy to prove. It's a bit like the spectral theorem, right? So the Darboux theorem is quite non-trivial, but what it says is that if what you want to diagonalize is anti-symmetric, you won't succeed, you can't completely diagonalize it, but you can put it into this form, and always with a 1 and minus 1. There are no eigenvalues that would be non-trivial. Can always choose a basis such that this is what happens. So for anti-symmetric ones, it's really different from the symmetric ones. Okay, so what this means is that the inner product between a solution to, if you choose such a basis, right, if you choose a so-called Darboux basis, such that the symplectic form takes this particular shape, then the basis vectors that have an even coefficient has an inner product with a basis vector, with the next basis vector that of course then is one up, so it's an odd coefficient, is one, because we're picking up this one here. And then if we take the inner product between one with an odd coefficient here, and here the even coefficient that does corresponds to it, then we pick up a minus 1. And all other pairings vanish. So there's always a pair of them that belongs together, and they behave like this. So what have we done so far? We have chosen a convenient basis in the space of solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, a Darboux basis. It turns out that Darboux bases are not unique. This is why an accelerated observer can see particles where an inertial observer doesn't, and vice versa. Because eventually we will see the Darboux bases, the choice of Darboux bases translates in your choice of mode functions, therefore in your choice of ANA Dagger operators, therefore in your choice of vacuum. Okay, but for now, let's just say the Darboux basis is not unique, but it's guaranteed to exist. At least one, in fact, many will exist. The Darboux theorem says there are bases in which the symplectic form takes this particular shape. And let's assume we've chosen such a basis. Then, let's say that A and B are arbitrary solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, which means that they can be written as linear combinations of our basis vectors. So if A and B are solutions, then A is some coefficients times these basis vectors, B is some coefficients times these basis vectors. And since we are dealing here with the vector space of real-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, A is real valued, the basis vectors are real valued, so these coefficients are also real valued for the A n and the B n. Then, if we write our vectors, our solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation as coefficients in that basis, in a Dabu basis, then we can write the inner product, the symplectic product between these two solutions as this sum here, simply using this property there. Okay, so now we assume we picked such a basis. We picked the Darboux basis in the space of real-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Now remember, we need to upgrade. The real-valued solutions will not lead us to our goal. Because on the right-hand side of the commutation relations, there was I Dirac delta of x minus x prime. And the left-hand side only had the field, only had the mode functions and their complex conjugates. And if the mode functions were real-valued, we would never get an I on the right-hand side. So let's upgrade this and let us look at the space of complex-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. Let's call that space V bar. It consists simply of twice that space, right? It's just the real-valued solutions plus I times, again, real-valued solutions. Now, let's write down a basis of V bar. Well, we can do it in this way. We can define for any of these two pairs of mode functions. Remember that there's always two mode functions that form together this 2x2 matrix in the Dabu diagonalization. Always the odd one and then the next, the even one and then one up. So for this pair of two mode functions, we can define un and un star in this way. In other words, the v2n is the real part of un and v2n plus 1 is the imaginary part of un. Right? It's just we choose this as the real part plus I times the imaginary part. That's the un. And un star is, of course, just a complex conjugate of that. And this transformation from vectors vn to vectors un is invertible. These guys are complex valued. And they have a real part and an imaginary part. The real part being the v with the even coefficients and the imaginary part being the v with the odd coefficients. Right. Now, since the Klein-Gordon equation and the inner product don't have I's in them, they don't mix the real and imaginary parts. And therefore, if the vn form a basis of the space of real-valued solutions, the un form un and the un star form a basis of the space of complex-valued solutions. Now let us look at what is a natural inner product on the space of complex-valued solutions. Remember, we had an inner product on the space of real-valued solutions, which turned out to be symplectic, because it's anti-symmetric. And then we did the Dabu diagonalization of it. Now, we are looking at the complex-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. These guys, these are the basis vectors here. And then we can ask, what is a natural inner product on these complex-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation? But here we define something very similar to the inner product that we had before. The inner product that we had before for the real-valued solutions was the thing with the round brackets. Here we define one with these edgy brackets. And it's going to be this inner product. Here we have an I, and the difference to before is that we have also complex conjugation in this. Then, knowing what this gives us, namely we have it diagonalized using the Dabu basis, we can easily work out what this edgy bracket is of the complex-valued solutions, namely of the un. It's a little bit of bookkeeping, but totally straightforward to check that the inner product of the complex-valued solution basis functions un and um is minus delta nm. And if you, that's the un's themselves. If you do it for the complex conjugated ones, then you get the plus Kronecker delta nm. And the inner product between the un's and the un stars is vanishing. So you see, this is quite different now from what the inner product was for the real-valued solutions. For the real-valued solutions, we had anti-symmetry. And as a consequence, couldn't diagonalize it. And we had to choose the Dabu basis. And in the Dabu basis, it was almost, the matrix was almost diagonal. But it was sort of block diagonal, where each block was off-diagonal with a 1 and a minus 1. But by going complex, we were able to remove those blocks and instead actually diagonalize the inner product. Namely, what we got is that the un-um inner product is diagonal, right? N has to be equal to m to get a value, and it happens to mean to be minus 1. And between the un's and um's, it's also diagonal. N has to be equal to m. And nothing in between them, which means you can view this as a diagonalization where you have that this inner product in the basis of the un and the um. That inner product is simply minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, and then 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. Right? Here you have the basis vectors that are the non-complex conjugated, just the un, and then down here you have the un stars. So it's diagonalized, but it's not positive definite. Right? So it's just the eigenvalues are minus 1 and then 1. So all of this is just a rewriting of what we had with the Dabu basis, where we were restricted to real valued, and then it wasn't completely diagonal because we had these little boxes. But because we extended this to complex valued solutions, the boxes disappeared, and instead we have a clean separation into minus 1s and 1s, and no boxes, it's just really diagonal there. Once we have this diagonal, we are almost there. We can, namely, we can now prove that a resolution of the identity in the space of complex valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation is given in this form. Now, I hope you all remember what the resolution of the identity is from quantum mechanics, right? So, for example, if you have in quantum mechanics, if you look at this equation, dx, that's the resolution of the identity, right? Similarly here, we have that the identity operator is given by this expression here, where this bracket belongs to that inner product. Remember, these are not Brass and Ketz in the quantum sense. These are just the halves of taking these inner products here. So what we obtain is that because of these relations, a resolution of the identity in the space of complex valued solutions can be written in this way. Let's prove this. Now, why would there be a minus sign here? Well, it's because the inner product between the un and the ums has a minus here. That's why we need a minus sign. Otherwise, it would be, if this was positive definite, if this was just ones, then it would be just a plain resolution of the identity. But they don't form a Hilbert space, because the Hilbert space would need to have a positive definite inner product. This doesn't, so we're not speaking of Hilbert spaces. It's not the usual resolution of the identity in a Hilbert space, but it's close to it. There is a construction that will turn this into a Hilbert space, and I am giving you some details here in this fine print, if you're interested in that. This is Krein spaces, but it doesn't. It's not important here. So what we need to prove is that we have this resolution of the identity. So let's check. If we apply the identity operator on un, so we get un. Remember what we mean by the identity operator? This one, right? If we apply this operator on a un, well, then what do we get? Then we get the un again. It's orthogonal to these guys. We get the un again up to a minus sign. If we apply the identity operator on a un star, we get the un star again. Okay, so what we obtain is we get this. Oh, just a sec, I have to show you this. There it is. Right. So if we apply this identity operator on a un, then we get a minus sign from here, but we get also a minus sign because it's defined in here. Therefore, if we apply that operator on a un, we get the un back. Two minus signs, right? From this eating up that, picking up a minus sign, but also here's a minus sign, so we get it back. And then if we apply that operator on a un star, then, yeah, we just get the un star back. So therefore, we have that this is a resolution of the identity. You may wonder, why do we want the resolution of the identity? Well, because the Wronskian condition turns out to be a resolution of the identity in the space of complex solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. Namely, let's check that. So if the identity written in this way with the un and the un star is a resolution, if this is a resolution of the identity, then we can apply it to any f which is in the space of complex valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. And we obtain that if we apply this, namely this is the identity operator after all, onto any state, if you apply it to any solution of the complex solution of the Klein-Gordon equation, then we get back that solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Now, let us spell out what this is. Remember that this edgy bracket is defined as an integral and so on, right? And these are explicit functions. So we can write out explicitly what this is. So what we have to prove, and we will do this now, but let me show you already where we want to end up. We want to show that this equation implies that, which is the Wronskian condition, which is the Holy Grail, right? That's what we want to show. We want to show that if we take a double basis, calculate from it by linear combination, double basis was the Vn's, calculate from it a complex basis of Un's, then these Un's, as complex valued functions of the Klein-Gordon equation, are the functions we need in our ansatz. Because if they are in there, in our ansatz, then the canonical commutation relations will hold. So the claim is that these U that are obtained by linear combination from the real valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation that we double diagonalized, then if you sum all of this stuff up, we get the Dirac delta with an I over there and so on and so on. And so therefore we solve the quantum field theory. So let's prove this. Okay, so what is the inner product between F and H again? If they are complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, remember this is what it was. And now it will also become clear why we chose these things here. I mean, first of all, we chose that, of course, in order to make it independent of time. But you will see that it also arranges itself to give us the Wronskian condition. All right, so we have here the inner product between two complex valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation. By definition, this is what it is. If we now write that in a coordinate system, because this might, you might not be very comfortable with this, if we write it in a coordinate system, then we are integrating here over a space-like hypersurface. We write this as d3x prime. And then this is a vector that points in the time direction, which is why we have a zero here. And then we have here these functions of space and time that we integrate over. So equation P, let's see, where is it? Here. The resolution of the identity applied to a function f is equation P. If we write this out using the knowledge that this is how this pointy bracket pans out, we obtain that The resolution of the identity takes this form. It's a little messy. So here's the resolution of the identity. Let's have another look. So we have the function un, and then the inner product between un and f, and then the same thing for the un stars. Okay, so we have the function un, and then the inner product between the u and f. And here, the other way around, function un star, and then the complex conjugate of that inner product. And then we know that this is equal to f. And we know that because we know we have a resolution of the identity. We proved that. So here we have an integral over a space like hypersurface. Here we have a sum. Let's assume that we can interchange the two. And we have here an integral, and here we have a sum. So we have plenty of terms here. Namely, we have four terms, right? We have this term, that term, this term, and that term. And if we write all of this out, then we obtain, once we pull this integral here on the left, so we obtain that the following is true. The integral over the sum over all of these, one term, two terms, three terms, four terms, same four that we counted up there, is equal to f of x and t because we know we have a resolution of the identity. Now, on the left-hand side of this equation, here, we have that f, our function, here, f, our function, is evaluated for all x prime, but only at one point in time, t naught. But on the right-hand side, we have f of x and t. Now, f is not an arbitrary function. F is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, right? F is any arbitrary solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, which means that this might still work out. If f was an arbitrary function, no way that something here done only at t naught would match what's over there at t. No, we can use that f is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Otherwise, it's unclear how this would work out. I mean, yeah, it couldn't be true, but it's true because the Klein-Gordon equation holds here. So now we can use the following. We can choose an arbitrary function, let's call it g of x prime. Then there will exist a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation which obeys the g of x prime as an initial condition at time t naught. And whose time derivative, covariantized time derivative, you see you have g naught nu dx prime nu. So this is, you can think of this as a time derivative, just a covariant version of it, where this time derivative vanishes. So we have a second order differential equation here. We are putting two initial conditions, namely this initial condition for f, for the amplitude, and this for the derivative. We can do this, this is consistent. So, there exists for any g of x prime where this is not a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. This is just simply any function now, but not of space and time, but only of space, right? So, for any function of space, g of x prime, there exists a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation which takes this as initial condition with as for its amplitude, and the initial condition for its time derivative is zero. Right? It's a trivial statement. We know that we can choose this. The point here is that we get to choose any arbitrary g of x and x prime, whereas this thing had to be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. So we're just relating the two. This is the exact point where global hyperbolicity is used in the theorem that we mentioned earlier. Right? If it's globally hyperbolic, the space-time, then we have a well-defined Cauchy problem at any time. And that's what we use here, that we have a well-defined Cauchy problem at t naught. That is to say that at any given time, we can choose initial conditions, amplitude and derivative, and that will determine the further evolution. Okay. So therefore, the equation that we had earlier, let me display it again here. And this equation here, we can now replace the F by the G. And then what we obtain is that this equation becomes this one, where we have that all of this stuff applied to G equal to G of X. G of X prime is equal to G of X. Now, because that has to be true for all G of X, all functions of space only, we must have that all of this must amount to the Dirac delta. Right? Because we have an integral over something times G of X prime is equal to G of X. So therefore, what we're integrating over here must be the Dirac delta of X minus X prime. So we can conclude, therefore, that what's in that integral, all of this stuff here, is I times the Dirac delta, because there's another I over here. And we swapped these two places around. All right. This is, of course, the Wronskian condition that we needed to prove. Okay, so with all of this work, what we've achieved is that we found out that it's doable. But none of this tells us how to do it, right? These methods don't tell us how to get a Dabu basis of real-valued solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation, for which we can then take the linear combinations of the two partner mode functions to get the complex-valued mode functions, for which we can then prove that the Wronskian condition is obeyed. But for now, we know it's going to be possible if the spacetime is globally hyperbolic. Now, so the conclusion then so far is that the commutation relations, the hermeticity condition, and the equations of motion are all going to be obeyed with this ansatz here, namely that we write our quantum field as mode function times annihilation operator plus mode function complex conjugated times creation operator, and then we define the pi hat such that the other equation of motion is also fulfilled, where we choose our A and A dagger operators to have these commutation relations, and we have to choose our mode functions such that they are number-valued and, in fact, complex-valued solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, which obey this Wronskian condition here. Now, there are two ways to go about doing this. There are two ways to do this. In principle, in general, if your spacetime has generic curvature, and there's no simplification due to symmetries, then we have to find a Dabu basis, right? So that you just have to find all solutions, the space of all solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, and then start Dabu diagonalizing, such that in that basis, you choose a basis in that space of real-valued solutions, such that then this inner product that we had there takes this block diagonal form. And once you have that, then you can take these solutions pairwise and construct a complex-valued solution, un, and a bunch of them is the solution. These are going to be those mode functions that you can put in here. And you see, the k is the label that labels then your basis. Now, later we will see that while we have so far proven existence, there is a huge non-uniqueness in this. Dabu bases are not unique. If you have a symmetric form, then let's say a Hermitian form, symmetric, then you can diagonalize, you get all the eigenvalues nicely lined up on the diagonal, and the basis is unique. Except if you had degeneracy, right? If you had degeneracy, then in the degeneracy space, you can still rotate and choose other bases. But other than that, it's unique. But for the taboo bases, it's not like that. There are plenty of different taboo bases you can choose. And the relationship between these taboo bases are in one-to-one correspondence to Bogoliubov transformations between the A and A daggers. And the reason is this. We can write our field phi hat choosing one set of taboo solutions here and have A and A dagger operators. But of course, if we choose to write our field in terms of a different set of solutions, then we have different operators here that we may call A tildes, A tilde and A tilde dagger. Right? And then if we choose yet another set of solutions here, then we might call these A's A double tilde and A double tilde dagger. Because after all, they describe the same field. Right? It's not like we get different fields. No, the different choices of taboo bases give us different representations of the same field. So if you change the bases here, you're changing these operators. They all always have the same commutation relations, but while they have the same commutation relations, they're still different operators. Because with different mode functions and the same operators, you wouldn't get the same field, right? So you're changing the mode functions. As you change the mode functions, you're changing your A's and A daggers as well. And so you always have in combination a choice of mode function and the A and A dagger that come with that. So as you change taboo bases, you're also changing which A and A daggers you use. And then the linear transformations between the taboo bases give you also linear transformations between the A's and the A daggers, and these are going to be Bogoliubov transformations. Right. Okay. So the outlook is this. We showed that the Wronskian condition, which ensures the validity of the canonical commutation relations, holds at one time, but we want the canonical commutation relations to hold always. What guarantees that the canonical commutation relations hold for all times? And we can prove this using Stokes' theorem and unitarity, as we will do later. And then we will address the question, I mean, this is just a formal thing to wrap things up, to prove that once, if you obey the canonical commutation relations at one time, you will obey them at all times. Just have to show that once. But more important for practical purposes is the question of, are these taboo bases unique? And the answer is, of course, no. And the math is that of Bogoliubov transformations between them. And then we will discuss what's the physics of this ambiguity. And the answer is that it has to do with the ambiguity of the vacuum. In principle, you can choose any arbitrary taboo basis you want, but it may not be convenient. For example, if you choose an arbitrary taboo basis, then your A operator may not annihilate the state that you consider to be the no-particle state. So we will discuss that, and we will see the Unruh effect, and then later the Hawking effect, and the creation of fluctuations in inflationary cosmology, all as arising from having to change the choice of taboo bases because the vacuum doesn't stay the same, because the vacuum gets excited. Right. Okay. So far, this is how far we get today. Any questions? Yeah?
But don't we have the canonical relationship holding at all time, then, as long as the inner product is the same for all time? Then surely the arguments we've gone through are valid.
That's right, and that's how we are going to show it too.
We
haven't shown it yet. That's right. That's how we're going to show it. But there's another way to show it too, which is that if you show that the Hamiltonian is self-adjoint, and the time evolution that it generates will preserve any kind of commutation relations, in particular the ones that we imposed at one time. It's just we have to still do the differential geometry to show that this inner product is the same, because what is time depends on how you foliate space-time. So we will have to show that it's foliation independent. Yeah, it's quite amazing that all of this works out. And in hindsight, I suppose we can understand why it had to work out, because there's Feynman's method, which quantizes the whole thing covariantly from the start. So in hindsight, no wonder that we can do it in the non-obviously covariant Hamiltonian formalism too. It's just that in the Feynman way of looking at things, we don't have Hilbert spaces to work with and operators and so on. So we are missing a lot of tools. We just get the endpoint functions directly.
So you talked about this, you have Cauchy hypersurface.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens if there's no Cauchy surface? Like,
Generally speaking, it's not clear how you quantize a theory then. And I should say that you don't even have to go as dramatic as not having a globally hyperbolic space-time. Even if you just enter interactions, then you already have to rethink all of this. Because this is very essentially used the fact that the solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation form a vector space, which required that the Klein-Gordon equation was linear. It contains the field only linearly. But now imagine that you have an action or a Hamiltonian that has interactions between fields. For example, quantum electrodynamics, where you would have the fermionic field and then the electromagnetic field, and the interaction term would have a psi bar a psi. So it's the third power. And, you know, the theory is no longer linear. The equations of motion are no longer going to be linear then. Or you have the Klein-Gordon equation with a phi to the 4 self-interaction term, no longer linear. So the whole argument here falls apart. And then you have to do things perturbatively and try to rescue things order by order. It's really a mess. There ought to be a better way to do this. Which is why, for interactions, usually people use the Feynman picture. Whereas when your interaction is with gravity, then you can stick to the framework of free quantum field theories. If they only interact with gravity, then you have an interaction, but it's still linear.
How does this work for like fermions, like roughly? Because the Dirac equation is complex, right?
Yes.
So does this fall apart then? Because
that's okay. Well, you have to go through the details to see how that works, but let me just remind you that each component of the Dirac equation, each component of the Dirac spinner, is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. Right? You can show that by writing, you know, if you have d/-m, right, acting on psi equal to 0, right? Then you can also multiply with d/+m, and that's the Klein-Gordon equation for each one of the components. Yeah. Because d/² is the Dirac version. Yeah. All right. So next week is reading week. No classes then. So I see you week after next. Okay, have fun in reading week.